Looks just like the first day of the term. Before I forget, I want to make sure that everyone realizes that exam 5 on Tuesday is not at 11:30, right? It's at 11 o'clock, so remember to show up at a half hour earlier. We haven't quite made it through this final chapter. I'm up to slide 6, and this has to do with heritable genetic disorders. Not all genetic disorders are heritable. A genetic disorder is simply any disorder that involves the genes, like cancer, for instance, as I said before, is genetic, but cancer is not heritable. Heritable genetic disorders are actually caused by the genes you get from parents. And heritable genetic disorders can involve any gene, therefore it could be autosomal, but in this case, it's sex. This one happens to be sex-linked that we're looking at, or this is actually a general scheme. It's not a specific disorder. And it just shows you how the genetics works here when two prospective parents mate. By the way, the symbology here is that a light-colored background means that that person is entirely normal. All of that person's alleles are the normal type that do not cause the disorder. Light-colored red means that that person is a carrier. So normal phenotype, does not have the disorder, but has a mutant allele that can lead to the disorder, and therefore if that person has children, can pass it on. And dark red means that person is actually affected. And these aren't all the possibilities. These are just three possibilities to show you how things work. If a totally, well, first of all, this is sex-linked, and therefore a woman has two alleles for the gene, a man has only one. But she is totally normal. She's homozygous dominant because, in this case, the dominant form is the normal non-disordered form of the allele. If she mates with a man that has the disorder, then these are the predictions. All of their daughters will be normal with respect to the disorder. They won't have it, but they'll all be carriers. And all of the males, any sons they have, will be totally normal, which makes sense, right? Because if you're a male, you had to have gotten your Y from your father, and that doesn't have the gene for the disorder. You have to have gotten your X from your mother, and she was totally normal. So that makes sense. In the middle one, we have a carrier mother and a normal father. In that case, half of the daughters will be totally normal. Half of them will be carriers. None of them will actually have the disorder. Half of the sons will be normal and half will be affected. And of these three, the riskiest of the possibilities would be if you have a carrier female and an affected male. In that case, half of the daughters will be affected, the other half will be carriers, none will be normal. Half of the sons will be normal, and that's the only possibility for a totally normal. Half of the sons will be affected. Of course, it would be even worse if you have an affected female and affected male. There's a 100% chance that all the children will be affected. All right, well, slide 7 also has to do with sex-linked characteristics or genes. What we're looking at here is an example of what is called dosage compensation. And so, in general, dosage refers to how much you get, right? Here, dosage specifically applies to how many alleles you get. It's going to be 2 for an autosome, right? But for a sex-linked gene, a female has twice the dosage compared to a male. She has 2 alleles, 1 for each of her 2 X's. He only has 1 allele. So they're not on equal genetic grounds because of that. And We're looking here at a cat, which is a fellow mammal. They use the XY system just like humans do. And their XY organ species are not the only ones with a dosage problem. It occurs in other sexual species as well. And different ways have evolved to compensate for the difference in dosage. That's what I mean by dosage compensation. And if you think about this as a just trying to solve the problems, assuming it's a problem that there's different dosages, there's two basic ways you could go about it. You could somehow bring the male up to the level of the female, or you could bring the female down to the level of the male to make them equal. And both of these have occurred in different species. But for mammals, including this cat, the way it occurs is by bringing the female down to the level of the male. And specifically, how this dosage compensation happens in cats and in mammals in general is through a process called X chromosome inactivation, which is just what the phrase says it is. One of the two X chromosomes in a female gets inactivated. She has two X chromosomes. One, they're both going to still be there, but one of them is going to be made unreadable, which will make the female on equal grounds with the male. That's what I meant by bringing her down to the level of the male. And the way this is done is by extensive methylation of one of the X chromosomes. Back when we talked about functional groups, I said that methylation is a way to control genes. Genes can be methylated, and that can keep them turned off in that type of cell. But here we're talking about methylation that's so extensive that the whole X chromosome gets inactivated. Actually, it's more than methylation. It's highly condensed. Just like the DNA condenses in preparation for cell division, for X chromosome inactivation, one of the two X's in a female gets highly condensed and stays condensed. It never unwraps for the entire lifetime of that individual. And, you know, this will happen, of course, in a cell. That's where the chromosomes are. When a cell inactivates one of its two X's, it will stay inactivated for all of the cells that that cell turns into as well. That's why it's for the lifetime of the organism. All right, now, if you have a female who is homozygous for one of these sex-linked genes, meaning ones that are on the X chromosome, if she's homozygous, then it really doesn't matter which of the two X's gets turned off, right? Because the other one's going to be carrying the same allele. But it does matter for a heterozygous individual. Like in fur color here. She's heterozygous for the fur color gene, which is on the X chromosome. One of her alleles is the orange version, one of them is the black version for fur color. And therefore, if you inactivate the black one, that's going to mean orange fur and vice versa. Well, if this X chromosome inactivation occurred when the cat is one cell, when it's a zygote, then it would just be a flip of a coin. The cat's going to be either pure orange or pure black when it grows up. Because once the decision is made for X chromosome inactivation, all the progeny cells that it turns into will have the same X chromosome inactivated. But it doesn't actually occur that early. It occurs early on in development, in the early embryo, but it's by then thousands of cells big, not just one cell. So it's just a ball of cells, picture that. Each one is now going to randomly choose one of the two X chromosomes to inactivate. Each one flips its own coin, basically. And once each coin is flipped, that cell will have a certain, will be either orange or black with respect to fur color. And therefore, and where the cell is in this ball of cells that we call the early embryo matters, because where it is in the cell will correspond to that part of the body once it develops into a cat. And that's why this cat, this adult female, is random with respect to color. It has orange spots that correspond to a cell in that part of the embryo that chose orange not to be inactivated, and black elsewhere. We call such a female a mosaic. So it's not really a pattern, like stripedness or something, it's just randomness. And you don't see this in males because they don't have two X chromosomes. You certainly would not want X chromosome inactivation to occur in male. That would be fatal, right? You can't turn off the only X chromosome it has. So this one is obvious just to look at the cat. But an adult human female can be a heterozygous individual with respect to the ability to freely sweat. And you don't really recognize it by looking at her. But if you got in there and really looked closely at the pores with a dissecting scope, there would be patches of her skin that could freely sweat and neighboring patches that couldn't, depending on which X chromosome got inactivated. But X chromosome inactivation is a particular type of dosage compensation. Now to eight. This cross involving flies here is a dihybrid cross originally, because there are two genes that we're looking at, two characteristics. Body color, which has two alleles, two traits. Gray color is dominant. Black is recessive. The other characteristic, the other gene, is for wing shape. A nice full wing is the dominant type. And what we call the vestigial wing, much reduced in size, is the recessive type. And so, just as we did with pea color, seed color, and seed shape, each of these is a double homozygous. This one's a double homozygous dominant. B stands for black, but when you put a plus, that means gray instead, the wild type. VG stands for vestigial, but when you put a plus, it's normal wing. This one's homozygous, double homozygous recessive, the black vestigial wing one. And not surprisingly, hopefully, at this point, if you cross these two, every one of the F1s is going to be doubly dominant, dominant for each of the two characteristics, because gray dominates over black and full wing dominates over vestigial wing. They'll all be double heterozygous individuals. Okay, nothing new there. This is a different, instead of mating these though, these F1s, to make an F2, what we're going to do is cross an F1 with another one of these double homozygous recessive individuals. It's a different kind of test cross. And the double homozygous recessive, of course, can only make one kind of gamete. This one happens to be the female, as you see. She can make only one kind of gamete when you pay attention to just these two things, because she's double homozygous. So he's going to give a sperm that has a B and a VG. That's the only possibility. That's why the Punnett square has only one row. But this F1 individual can make four different kinds of eggs, right? All combinations of B, B plus, VG, and VG plus, right there. Therefore, the Punnett square shows you the four possible zygotes in their pictures. Now, I need to give you definitions here. Notice that the first two zygotes in the Punnett square are like one or the other parent, the original parents. And that's why we call these ones parental types. They're like one parent or the other. These other two aren't like either parent. Each of them has the color of one parent and the wing shape of the other parent. And so they are not parental types, they are called recombinant types. Because they result from a recombination of the parent's genes. Well, the Punnett square, as usual, is a predictive device. It allows you to have predicted ratios, or it gives you predicted ratios. But there are two different hypotheses being tested here. And one of them has to be true, because the two hypotheses are that the two genes we're looking at are on the same chromosome. That's one hypothesis. Or the two genes are on two different chromosomes, the other hypothesis. One of those has to be true, right? Genes aren't just by themselves, they're on chromosomes. So they're either both on the same chromosome or they're not. Well, this brings up another definition. Definition of linkedness. Linked genes, that phrase, has nothing to do with sex-linked, so be careful with the words. It makes sense to talk about a single gene being sex-linked or not. That just, you know, sex-linked simply means that individual gene is on a sex chromosome. So it's either sex-linked or autosomal. It does not make sense to talk about a single gene being linked. We use the term linked to refer to at least two genes or more. So we can say that two genes are linked, and all that means is that those two genes are on the same chromosome. It doesn't matter what kind of chromosome. You can have linked autosomal genes or linked sex-linked genes. And so that's why I'm saying one of these two hypotheses has to be true. Either these two genes are linked or they are not. But let's look at the predicted ratios. If they are not linked, if genes are located on different chromosomes is what that means, then you would expect all four of these possible zygotes to be created. You'd expect a 1-to-1-to-1-to-1 ratio because they're all equally likely. On the other hand, if they are linked, then you would expect a 1-to-1-to-0-to-0 ratio. Because if they're linked, they are passengers on a chromosome, and wherever the chromosome goes, they both go. All right? That's why you would expect only parental types. In other words, color goes along with wing shape, because they're on the same chromosome if they're linked. You would expect these two possibilities. So that's what 1-to-1-to-0-to-0 means. Well, one of these has to be true, right? But look at the actual numbers on the bottom. Neither one of the predicted ratios came true. There's roughly 1,000 of each parental type and only a couple hundred of each recombinant type. So the fact that these are not in a 1-to-1-to-1-to-1 ratio, which you wouldn't notice unless you did a bunch, so that's the sample size importance. But with the sample size this big, you know this is not just by chance that you got this drastic difference from the 1-to-1-to-1 ratio. So that means that they must not be on different chromosomes, because with that high a sample size, it really should be very close to 1-to-1-to-1-to-1. On the other hand, the other one said that these ones shouldn't be possible, and they did happen, the recombinants. So what's the solution here? What's the explanation? How can two alleles that are on the same chromosome, one for each of two different genes, be separated from each other? What did you learn about that explains it? Two alleles that are on the same chromosome to begin with end up being in different cells. How can that happen? Replication. Not replication, because replication is just going to make an exact copy. And so things aren't going to change. There are just going to be more of them. Splitting of what? Yes, crossing over. That's the explanation. Crossing over can actually separate two linked alleles, as we can see in slide 9. So this is the same cross, but now we're paying attention to the chromosomes. And only one type of chromosome is shown here, because it's the only one that has these two genes on them. We're ignoring all the other chromosomes. All right. So the original cross, you have a Well, not the original cross. The F1 with Tess crossed with the black vestigial wing one. So she's a double heterozygous individual. That's why she has one chromosome that's B plus VG plus. The other one is BVG.
Okay.
Well, if crossing over has to happen in order to separate either B plus from VG plus or B from VG. But it's not enough to just say crossing over. Remember, crossing over is random. The chiasma, which is the crossover point, can happen anywhere along the length of the chromosome. Well, here you have the two loci involved. This is their positions on the chromosome of the two genes. If crossing over happens anywhere to the left of this B gene, it wouldn't matter, right? You swap these parts out, it's not going to affect these. They're still going to be together. And similarly, if crossing over happens anywhere to the right of the VG gene, it's not going to separate them. So not only does crossing over have to happen, it has to specifically happen between the two gene loci. Does that make sense logically? You sure? It doesn't? Let's say you cross it over right here. You would swap this part with this part. That's not going to affect whether these two are together. But here's showing it actually occurring right between the two, and that's why it's occurring somewhere right in the middle here. So pink and red are swapped here. That's what separates the two. This one is now a B plus with a VG instead of a VG plus. Does that make sense now? Okay. So that's why you can have linked genes still give rise to recombinant types.
That happened prophase, right?
Prophase of meiosis one. Prophase one. That's when the tetrads come together, they synapse, and that's when crossing over occurs. Okay. Now, back before we could just easily look at DNA, this is decades ago, a grad student in a genetics lab figured out mathematically that how easily you get recombinant types, once you know that genes are linked, how easy it is to get recombinant types gives you an idea of where these gene loci are, where their locations are. This is the early part of gene mapping. So when you know that two genes are linked, all that really tells you is that those two genes are on this chromosome together. Doesn't it all tell you where they are? But he figured out that by computing what's called the recombination frequency, you can figure out how close they are to each other on that gene, on that chromosome. And it's mathematically, it's pretty simple. It's a fraction. You take the recombinant types, so that's 206 plus 185, that's where they came up with the 391, and then divide by the total number of offspring, which is the 2300. And then you multiply by 100 to make it a percentage, 17% in this case. The lower that recombination frequency is, the closer the two genes must be. Because the closer they are together, the more unlikely it is that a chiasma is going to form between them. It's just an odds thing. The farther they are apart, the more likely that a chiasm will be between them, and therefore they'll be separated. By the way, if recombination frequency should never go above 50%, because if they're on the same gene but on opposite ends, that's the maximum possibility that a chiasma is going to form between them. But it's either going to form or not. So there's still going to be only a 50% chance of recombinance and a 50% chance of parentals. Okay? So anyway, this is how he went about gene mapping. This is before we could just get in there and read. Slide 10 shows you that if you do this, and it takes a long time to do this because you have to go through a lot of crosses. Go through a lot of crosses like we just looked at, but each one pays attention to two particular genes. Like this one we just looked at was the B and the VG gene, but you also do one with B and CN gene, and then you do one with CN and VG genes. You compute the recombination frequencies for all of them, In this case, you have 9 and 9.5% and 17% for these. Well, the fact that this one's so much bigger means that this gene must be between these two genes. That's the logic there. Yeah. Alleles are specific versions of the gene. So the gene corresponds to the characteristic. The allele, whatever it is, corresponds to a specific trait of that characteristic. Yeah, so there's a body color gene, but there's two alleles for it, black and gray.
And that's, these bands are the genes themselves?
Well, these bands are the loci, the positions that the alleles occupy. Okay, but this is the black version, the black allele, the black version of the gene for body color. In a heterozygous individual, the other chromosome that's homologous to this would have the same gene but the different version of it, the gray version, which would be the B+. And slide 10 just continues this rationale. You just keep doing crosses two at a time. Paying attention to two genes at a time, and then you can make a more and more extensive map. So this is a lot of work that we don't have to do nowadays because we can just get in there and sequence DNA, but this is how they did it originally. And these numbers are just relative. So they put zero to this one that at the end. All these other numbers means it's in relation to zero. It's not really real distances or anything. All right. Now to 12. We've studied meiosis before, and hopefully you remember all that. And meiosis, just like mitosis, of course, involves separation of something. But meiosis, remember, has two division events, so there's two separation events, one in meiosis I and one in meiosis II. Usually that goes off without a hitch, the separation, that is. And another word for separation is disjunction. To disjoin means to separate. So disjunction is the normal process. That's what usually happens without a problem. But not always. Accidents happen. And sometimes the things that are supposed to disjoin do not. So when that happens, we call it non-disjunction, which is a type of error. And this brings up another definition. If a cell has the normal, correct number of chromosomes for that species and cell type, then we call that condition euploidy. Eu, just like in eukaryote, means true or good. So having the correct ploidy is what euploidy means. That's the normal situation. Any other number that, other than normal for a given cell, is an example of the opposite of euploidy, which is aneuploidy. An means not. And that can happen for various reasons, but it happens because of non-disjunction in meiosis. I mean, that's one way it can happen. Most likely way it can happen. And what we see here is that it doesn't matter whether the non-disjunction occurs in meiosis I or meiosis II. Either way, it leads to aneuploidy. But if it happens in meiosis I, if non-disjunction happens in meiosis I, and notice, by the way, it's only happening for chromosome 1, the larger one. Chromosome 2, that tetrad splits normally. But chromosome 1 is not splitting. And when it does not disjoin, that means one of the two daughter cells gets all of it, the other gets nothing for that chromosome type. Well, each of those is a bad problem, right? Which is the worst problem? Getting too many chromosomes or getting too few?
Too few.
Yeah, why? Right, if you don't get that type of chromosome, you don't have any of those genes, and therefore you're incapable of making all of those kinds of proteins, which is not going to allow you to live. Having too many, you have all your genes, but you have too much information, that can lead to problems too, just not as bad a problem as having too few. But the point here is that non-disjunction occurring in meiosis one is going to give rise to two aneuploid cells. Each of these is aneuploid, but for a different reason. This one has too much, this one has too few. And therefore, even if they undergo normal meiosis two, all four of these cells are going to be aneuploid. If the first round goes off, no problem in meiosis one, but then the non-disjunction happens to one of those cells in meiosis two, then you're going to have two gametes being produced that are aneuploid and two that are normal. All right. So this is how, for instance, Down syndrome, which is an example of a trisomy, having three of a chromosome instead of two, happens. Okay, slide 13. We're looking at mutations again. We studied mutations earlier in a different chapter, but those were point mutations, which are very small-scale mutations. They can have big effects, like we talked about, but they're going to affect just a single protein, and whatever that protein affects, of course. Here we're talking about much larger scale changes to the DNA. So it's still mutation, but these are chromosomal mutations. And the chromosome that we're looking at here has letters associated with it. Those letters are not genes. Each letter is just a region on a chromosome that contains many genes within it. Okay? So even if something only affects one of these letters, that's a really big effect because there's a lot of genes in that area. Well, we have different categories, just like we did before for point mutations. Deletion refers to removing something. So in this case, the D region gets cut out somehow. ABCDE becomes ABCE and so on. This means you're missing genes, and that's going to be a very big problem. Hard to survive that. Duplication means something gets copied. So BC region gets copied and put next to it. ABCDE becomes ABCBCDE. Now this one is not only possible to survive, it actually, we have evidence that it happens fairly often in species, including us. So remember that most of our DNA sequence is actually not in genes. It's between genes. Well, if duplication occurs, you have two versions of a certain number of genes. And therefore, it doesn't really matter what happens to that new copy, because you still have your original. And that's why you can survive this. But also, it can also, in a sense, be advantageous, because it gives you other copies to just let mutation go wild with an experiment, in a sense. Not intentionally experiment. But that's what duplication is. Invert means to flip. So inversion means one of these regions breaks, gets flipped around, and then reinserted. A, B, C, D, E becomes A, D, C, B, E. Well, nothing is taken away or added in this one, but it still can cause problems. First of all, wherever it gets cut, that occurs somewhere in the sequence, right? Chances are, because the sequence between genes are most of your DNA, that that's going to happen in one of those non-coding regions. But it could happen right in the middle of a gene, and therefore that gene would be destroyed. That would be problematic. But even if no gene gets destroyed at these cuts before it flips, the genes are still there, but they're not in the same position that they were, and that can be a bad thing, because one of the functions of the non-coding regions, I'm not going to get into how this works, but one of the functions is to help control the transcription of the genes. It regulates gene expression, and therefore putting them in a different position can cause them to be permanently turned off or permanently turned on. And either of those is a problem. You don't want to be making proteins unless you need those proteins. The most complex of the ones here listed here is the bottom one, the reciprocal translocation, because that involves two separate kinds of chromosomes, each of which breaks apart. But then the pieces, instead of going back to where they're supposed to on the correct chromosome, they're swapped. So it's kind of like accidental crossing over, but not between homologs. It's totally different kinds of chromosomes. And there's a specific example shown in 14. For whatever chemical reason, this actually happens compared to other reciprocal translocations fairly often in humans. I forget whether it's 1 in 10,000 or something. This happens to involving chromosomes 9 and 22. And so this leads to an abnormal chromosome 22 called the Philadelphia chromosome, which is one of several ways that a human can develop leukemia. And that'll bring us to 15, which I included in here just to give you an introduction to another term, which is epigenetic effects. We've discussed mostly genetic things, things directly involving the genes or changes in the genes. And that, of course, you know, if you change genes, you obviously you're going to change phenotype, right? Well, epigenetic effects are changes to phenotype that occur without actually changing genes. Epigenetic effects actually affect how genes get expressed. And so there's all kinds of epigenetic effects. This is just one example called genomic imprinting. Genomic is the adjective of genome. The genome refers to all of the DNA, the entire library for the organism. Okay, so each of your nucleated genes has the full genome. But genomic imprinting is just one example of an epigenetic effect, and what it involves is inactivation of one of the two alleles in the diploid organism, just one a gene on one of the chromosomes but not on the other, gets inactivated by methylation for the lifetime of that organism. And it's not random like X chromosome inactivation is. It's usually depends on which of the two genes came from the mother or the father. In this case, the mother's version, the one that's passed from the mother, the red one, gets turned off in the offspring's lifetime. Gets reset if that organism then reproduces. So each generation it gets reset. But it gets turned off for the lifetime of this mouse. And the paternal one is the one that remains on. So it doesn't really matter phenotypically for a homozygous individual, right? You turn off the mother's, but the father's is the same version, so no change in phenotype. But it does matter for a heterozygous individual, as we see on the bottom. There's two ways to be heterozygous, right? You can get dominant from the father, recessive from the mother, or recessive from the father, dominant from the mother. In each of these cases, though, it's the father's one that stays on. So in this case, he got the normal one from the father. That's why he's a normal mouse, normal-sized mouse. And this heterozygous individual, though, same genotype. It's the mother's version that the father's version, which is the one that stays on, is the mutant version that makes him a dwarf mouse. The normal-sized one gets turned off because it came from the mother. Same genotype, different phenotypes because of epigenetic effects. And that is the chapter, and therefore the unit. So you've not only made it through all the lectures, you have just sat through the last lecture of my career. Yep, that's, yes indeed. Thank you.